This one is more my size, I guess. I'm a little like the chairman I drank too long. I'm very happy to be here on Gratitude Sunday. I must say that I know very well that there are people in the audience who perhaps it would be more appropriate if they were here and I was were there. Such people as Freddie Williams from Maslin, my good friend sitting about halfway back, and my friend Alex Mark from Ravenna, and there may and are undoubtedly more who have been associated with this fellowship much longer than I have. However, when I became associated with AA, my sponsors told me that I should never refuse any request that I could reasonably accept. And that's why I'm here today. As I was sitting out in the audience listening to the preliminaries, it occurred to me that, and this is a very obvious thing, of course, that all of us should be grateful for the fact that Alcoholics Anonymous existed and still exists during our lifetime. You see, this wasn't always so. And as I sat there listening to the chairman and to Mr. Mills, I couldn't help but speculate as to where I and all of you who are alcoholics would be this afternoon had it not been for AA. This is enough to make a strong man shudder, believe me. I'm sure that a great many of us, including myself, wouldn't be in existence, far less a sober, happy existence. So I think we should all give a little thought to being grateful for the fact that AA was here when we needed it. This morning, having some uncertainties as to what might be appropriate for me to say, of all things, I picked up a little book, which I found, incidentally, among my great-grandfather's belongings some years ago. This is entitled The Confessions of a Reformed Inebriate. This book was published in 1844, and it was dedicated to the members of the so-called Washington Temperance Society, commonly known as the Washingtonians. Now, it's a curious thing that almost 100 years prior to the time that Bill and Dr. Bobbs had their meeting in Akron, the so-called Washingtonian Society originated in the city of Baltimore, Maryland, April 2, 1840. History has it that these six founders of the Washingtonians were sitting around, as was their custom, spending the evening drinking. And in a spirit of jest, they sent one or two of their members down the street to a church in which there was being held a temperance lecture. And the delegation came back after a half an hour, perhaps an hour, very enthusiastic about total abstinence, which, of course, was the subject of the lecture. Whereupon, the six so-called convivial companions decided then and there that they would form a society which would espouse the cause of total abstinence. And that's where the Washingtonians were born. History records that within 2 years, they had something in excess of 500,000 members. Now, don't misunderstand me. All of these 500,000 members, so-called, were not alcoholics in the sense that we think we know what an alcoholic is. And perhaps the greatest mistake that these people made was to form a temperance society. In other words, they were advocating something. Also, they got embroiled in two arguments, one having to do with God and religion. In other words, they're somewhere along the line, there got to be a great debate as to whether the so-called Washingtonians, the recovered inebriates, had to depend upon God and religion. And this led to a great deal of dissension in their ranks. Secondly, being members of a temperance society, they became embroiled in the question as to whether total abstinence needed legislation controlling the sale and the use of alcoholic beverages. So it became something of a political society. Oddly enough, again, I depend upon recorded history, within 10 years from the date the organization was started, namely around 1850, it had ceased to be influential in the cause of temperance. I don't know whether we OAs owe a debt of gratitude to the Washingtonian Temperance Society or not. I doubt very much whether Bill and Bob had heard of the Washingtonian Society when AA was born. Be that as it may, there was one very important point which developed out of that Washingtonian experience, and that was that the fellowship of people suffering from alcoholism was proved to be much more effective than lectures or sermons from non-alcoholics. In other words, even back then, the fact that this organization was started by six drunkards led them to the conclusion that one drunk could help another. And of course, as we all know, this is at the heart of our AA success. Well, so much for the Washingtonians. I think we all know, in some degree or another, that in the early days of AA, there was a sort of affiliation with the Oxford groups. I don't know how familiar any of you are with the movement of the Oxford groups. It may well be that there are some of you who are members of Oxford groups. I don't know. In any event, it seems to me that we in AA owe a great deal of gratitude to the formation and development of the Oxford groups. Again, history has it, the Oxford group or groups started back in 1921. Started by an American former Lutheran minister, Frank Buchman, or Frank Buckman, however you want to call it, who at that time was visiting Oxford University in England. The Oxford group, as you might well expect, had principles for the conduct of their members, which in many ways sound like some of the principles we find in AA. I suppose most of you are aware of the fact that both Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson were associated with Oxford groups in Akron and in New York, respectively, at the time they got together in 1935 in Akron. And as I don't recall it, obviously, but as I recall my reading, the very first group of AA, the forerunner of the meeting at King's School, was held in a home on Palisades Drive, in the home of T. Henry Williams, who was one of the staunch supporters of the Oxford groups here in Akron. It's from the Oxford groups that we receive, for example, the four absolutes of honesty, purity, love, and unselfishness. Again, this is somewhat peculiar. I suppose those of us here in Akron, if my experience has been the same as yours or in Cleveland, at least in this area, we hear and heard a great deal about the four absolutes when we became associated with AA. I'm told that those AAs who became associated in New York City didn't hear about the four absolutes. And I think this is correct, that you can look through the AA book and you won't find any reference to the four absolutes in the book. So this is something that was picked up from the Oxford groups and has carried through, at least in our program in this area. Other principles developed by Frank Buckman and his associates included the notion that a person had to surrender his will to the care of God. A person had to acknowledge, perhaps openly, at least within the privacy of meetings of the Oxford group members, his defects of character. The principle of making amends, or of restitution, as they called it in the Oxford group philosophy, we find in AA. Now, those members of the Oxford group likewise were admonished to go out and change other persons' lives. And so this principle of helping other people, which we find so essential, which is set forth in the 12th step of our own program, is a carryover from the Oxford group. In the book entitled AA Comes of Age, which was shown on the screen a while back, Bill makes the statement that in New York City, AA and the Oxford group came to a parting of the ways about 1937. And I think he also tells of the fact that Sam Shoemaker, the minister from Pittsburgh, who at that time had the Calvary Church in New York, and who was very active in the Oxford group movement, and whose name was mentioned in the clip film that you saw earlier, was a great supporter of AA in the early days. Bill also made the statement in the same book that in the Akron area, the separation of AA from the Oxford group didn't take place until 1939. And you will recall that the lady whom Bill Wilson made contact with in his famous telephone call from the Mayflower Hotel Henrietta Sabeling was a very active member of the Oxford group at that time, as was Dr. Bob Smith. I don't know, frankly, whether the Oxford group movement, or moral rearmament, as it's frequently called, has passed its heyday or not. It has had some remarkable successes, not only here, but in other countries. It may well be that ultimately AA will assume a more significant place in the world's history than the Oxford group movement. I don't know. But I think all of us AAs, as I said earlier, owe a deep debt of gratitude to the Oxford group, and particularly to those people in the Oxford group who were in existence in 1935 when AA started. I hope that I am grateful today, not only for AA, but I hope that I'm very grateful that I'm able to stand here today and be sober. Had it not been for AA and you fine people in AA, I wouldn't have had the pleasure and the privilege of enjoying some 18 years plus of total abstinence from alcohol. Believe me, this is a miracle in my own life, and I dare say that all of us AAs who have had similar experiences can describe them in no other manner than as than being miraculous. I have sometimes said, and I say it again, that I knew more about alcoholism after I had been associated with AA a week or two than I know today. And it isn't because I haven't given it a great deal of thought and a great deal of study, but actually, and I'm very truthful about it, I think I know less today about alcoholism than I thought I did after I had been a member of AA for about a week. Jess Crosby, who I'm glad to say is here too, has sometimes described the AA program as a simple program for complicated people. And I didn't find it very simple. In my own case, I found that it was pretty difficult. And I suppose this is an individual problem. One of the important aspects of AA, which I believe, if I'm correct, was not true in the Oxford group movement, was that very important phrase, as we understand him, or as we understood him. In other words, in the Oxford groups, the concept of the Almighty God was thrust upon the new member, so to speak. I know of no organization of any kind except AA which depends upon its survival and its success upon the Almighty, which permits its members to have, each to have, his own concept of that higher power. Your concept of a higher power might simply be your fellow members of AA. It can be anything. And I think this fundamentally, perhaps, is the reason why AA has been so successful, as our chairman said, in attracting members as it has been. This, of course, is an individual program. There are no so-called musts in AA. Our 12 steps are labeled as suggested steps. I'm sure in my own case I would have greatly resented anybody telling me what I had to do. So I think this business of being permitted to develop your own concept of God, your own philosophy of working the AA program, is perhaps the most important single thing which has made AA so successful. I don't know today what an alcoholic is. I'm sure that it would be entirely wrong for me to sit in judgment on any person or his behavior and come to the conclusion that he or she is an alcoholic. I don't have that kind of wisdom. In fact, I didn't have the kind of wisdom that would permit me to come to the conclusion that I was an alcoholic until I had seen and heard, seen examples and heard people talk, and until I had read about the experience of other people who admittedly were alcoholics. This seems to be one of the chief hazards or stumbling blocks which keeps alcoholics from recognizing that they have this terrific illness and keeps a great many people from quickly coming to the conclusion that they should associate themselves with Alcoholics Anonymous. Call it pride, if you will. Call it a reluctance to admit the necessity for surrendering your life, the reluctance to admit that your life has become unmanageable. This comes particularly hard to any person who, like myself, was egotistical and arrogant together. I don't know whether all alcoholics are egotistical or not. I'm never surprised, however, to hear one say that he was egotistical. I'm never surprised to hear one say that he was arrogant, because these seem to be traits which are more or less common to us alcoholics. I don't believe, and I speak only for myself, I don't believe that I would have been interested in joining an Oxford group, frankly. This would have smacked too much of religion. This would have smacked too much of things of a spiritual nature. And when I attended my first meeting of AA, I had no desire, believe me, I had absolutely no desire to become associated with anything of a religious or a spiritual nature. In spite of all of the trouble that alcohol had caused me, I still hadn't reached the point, I know, where I would have been willing to join some religious organization such as the Oxford Group. I didn't want that. In fact, it was hard enough for me to come to my first meeting of AA. And prior to my attending that first meeting, which was down in Canton, in October of 1945. Nobody had said to me, "Do you believe in God, or are you willing to surrender your will and the care of your life to God as you understand Him?" No, they didn't say that. Nobody had said to me, "Is your life unmanageable? And if it is, you better come to AA." No, they didn't say that. See, we alcoholics are a very sensitive people. And I don't believe that many of us, there are exceptions, of course, but I don't believe that many of us would have been too enthusiastic about joining a group like AA if these had been the questions. No, the questions were rather, are you having trouble with your drinking? Have you lost control of your drinking? Is drinking causing you trouble, either at home or in your business? If it is, if this is your problem, then we think we have something in which you may be interested and which we believe will be helpful. This was the attraction to me. I think people who come to AA are very desperate people. They have been through the mental tortures of not knowing which way to turn. People like me who had been accustomed to drinking every day of their lives for a good many years, and who willy-nilly got drunk if they took one drink, after a period of time, the human body becomes unable to cope with this kind of existence. Physically, you deteriorate. And I needn't add that mentally you deteriorate. I mean, after all, you can't have the sweats, the night sweats, if you please, night after night, week after week, and month after month, without causing you some mental disturbance. And you can't go along day after day with the shakes all day long until such time as you're able to get some alcohol into your system. And feeling guilty all day long, unwilling, and perhaps even unable to meet people and look them in the eye. You can't do this over a long period of time without causing yourself considerable mental torture and anguish. I'm sure, too, that most of us alkies who came to AA thought many and many a time of destroying ourselves. We had lost, you know, in a sense, we had lost our self-respect, and yet I suppose the reason we didn't destroy ourselves, the major reason, was because with it all, with all of the disgraceful things that we did, somehow or other, we thought we were still pretty nice people. And this is quite a paradox. How I, for example, could believe that I was a good lawyer, and I was practicing law down in Canton at the time, how I could believe that I was a good lawyer when I was physically unable to get up on my feet in those few instances where I found myself in court. I was physically unable to get up and talk because of the effects of consumption, excessive consumption of alcohol over a period of time. And I'm sure that those clients who were unfortunate enough to have me represent them, had their rights prejudiced time and time again, solely because of my inability to get on my feet and make some kind of a statement. And yet, I considered that I was a pretty good lawyer. I mean, how silly can you get? I thought that I was a pretty good father to my kids. Sure, they had plenty to eat. They had a home. I didn't pay any attention to them, of course. Very seldom saw them. Most of the time, when, unfortunately, they were, the two of them we had at that time were little kids, but they were usually in bed by the time I got home. And in the morning, of course, even had I wanted to spend some time with them, physically I wasn't able to. It took all of my strength to get out of the house. I thought I was a pretty good husband. You see, it was my wife who was having all the trouble, not me. She had a nice home. She had a car to drive anywhere she chose. She had all of those things that I thought women who were married ought to have. The only thing she lacked was she didn't appreciate me. As far as I could see, she wasn't doing anything to help me. I was supposed to be an up-and-coming young attorney, and I had visions of having a wife who would put me in the social whirl, you know, and we'd be entertained by all the, quote, best, close quote, people in the city. We never did this. We never had the so-called best people in our home. Never did. I thought this was a strange thing, and it obviously showed a lack of appreciation on the part of my wife. Now, sure, there were times when I'd bring people home. They weren't exactly what you'd call the best people. But occasionally, the ones I brought home weren't too bad. And occasionally, they were respectable people. And so occasionally, when they were respectable people, we would sit down perhaps for an evening card game, bridge. I loved to play bridge, still do. And yet it seemed completely compulsive on my part to get myself so drunk that I couldn't see one card from the other. I didn't recognize that my conduct during these evenings was the conduct of an alcoholic. I didn't realize that there were men and women in this world besides me who would sneak a couple of quickies as they went out to mix drinks for the guests. I didn't realize until I came to AA that there were other people who hid whiskey all over the house at various convenient spots, like next to the furnace, where they could have a couple of cookies when they went down to tend to the furnace. Never occurred to me that anybody except me would engage in this kind of activity. And yet, I know today that these things that I was doing were being done, and I guess are still being done, by drinking alcoholics. We all have similar patterns of behavior. If I had thought about it, if anybody had said to me that Joe Dokes slept more frequently on the floor than he did in his bed, I'd say that Joe Dokes was nuts. Never occurred to me to think I was crazy, and yet by actual count, I wouldn't be surprised that over a period of a year, I slept more frequently on the floor or the davenport than I did in bed. Now, you can't do these things over 5, 10, 15 years without causing some considerable damage to your own self. You can't do these things without wondering, what's the matter with it? If you've got any spark of decency left, and most of us did, you can't help but wonder what's going to become of you. How are you going to get out of this merry-go-round? I know on one occasion I had invited some of my family up for dinner, not with my wife's consent, by the way. But anyway, when they came, I was passed out, as I usually was, up in bed. And after the guests had had their dinner and just before they went home, one of my uncles came up to my room, got me awake. I've forgotten now whether he was profane or not. He might have been. But anyway, the substance of his comment was, what in the hell are we going to do with it? Even in my alcoholic stupor, I recall very distinctly that I answered him to this effect. I don't know that anybody can do anything with me until I find out what to do for myself. You see, I had no idea of what to do. Nobody likes to be considered a drunk. Nobody likes to be criticized, and especially sensitive people like alcoholics. They don't like to be criticized. And so when you know that people are talking about you, when you know that people say about you, you'd be a pretty good lawyer or whatever your occupation may be if you didn't drink so much, these aren't the things we like to hear, or no. We're too prone to need that pat on the back. This is the kind of contact with other people that we enjoy. Praise, not criticism. And yet, who in the world can give praise to a chronic alcoholic? What does a chronic alcoholic do, or what can he do that can merit any words of commendation or praise from his fellow men? So we get to be very miserable people, very lonesome people. And the longer we go, the more the narrower the shell in which we live. Until finally, if something isn't released, we shall destroy ourselves, come what may. Now, oddly enough, again, with all that history of chronic alcoholism, with all of those headaches, heartaches, backaches, toothaches, leg aches, you name it, I had it, I was most reluctant to come to an AA meeting. It didn't worry me that people saw me walk the public streets in a very wobbly condition. It didn't seem to worry me if people saw me in a tavern passed out, or wherever it might be. It didn't seem to bother me when the policeman or the sheriff would wake me up someplace in the county, too drunk to drive. In one episode that we were talking about before the meeting started today, they found me in the middle of one of the main streets down in Canton about 3 o'clock in the morning, slumped over the steering wheel. That was bad enough, except I guess as I slumped over, I hit the horn. And so the horn was blowing continuously. This didn't seem to bother me. Now, of course, it did. I say it didn't seem to. And yet, when we finally decide to try to do something about our problem, we become thoroughly ashamed. And I'm sorry to say to you fine people that feeling of shame that I had wasn't dissipated for at least 3 or 4 months after I attended that first meeting. I didn't want to talk to non-alcoholics about my alcoholic problem. As a matter of fact, while I knew that I drank too much, and while I knew that all of the trouble that I had gotten into in my life was the result of drinking, yet, for some strange reason, I wasn't able to convince myself that alcohol was my real problem. We have lots of problems. Business problems, domestic problems, all kinds of problems, financial problems. Funny, isn't it, that we can't blame alcohol we blame other people. We can't blame ourselves. This was a great disappointment to me when I finally came to it, that if I wanted to recover, I had to change myself. I couldn't take a couple of pills a day. I couldn't take a shot in the arm every week or two and recover from my alcoholism. I had to do it one day at a time, and in effect, although there was plenty of help, I had to do it myself for myself. It isn't pleasant to come to the realization that these characteristics of self-pity, of resentment, of selfishness, and hatred, these are the things which have caused our dilemma. And these are the traits that belong to me, not to my wife, to me. When I came to AA, nobody said, your wife is a very selfish person and we'll have to get her over that. Nobody said to me, your wife is a very resentful person and we'll have to get her over that. Oh, no. Rather, they said to me, you and you alone have been responsible for the dilemma in which you find yourself, and you alone will have to readjust, will have to re-educate yourself if you expect to recover from your disease. Now, I must say that the discovery that I was afflicted with the disease was a very comforting discovery. Somehow or other, I was able to tolerate these other disappointments, this finding out that I was the guy that caused my trouble. So long as I was able, again, you see, to blame it on something, and if I was afflicted with a disease, then somehow or other, I wasn't really responsible for the way in which I was behaving. So this is a very comforting thought. And I don't mean to be facetious at all, because I'm thoroughly convinced today that alcoholism is a disease. Insidious as it is, it's still a disease. And while we may be at fault in voluntarily exposing ourselves to alcohol, nevertheless, in my book, alcoholism is just as much a disease as any other of the recognized diseases and should be treated as such. Well, I went along in this program. Sure, I had some trouble. I don't think I was ever an atheist. I don't believe I ever had the courage to be an atheist. Agnostic was a nice sounding word. And you know, a fellow could claim to be an agnostic. This didn't really make him admit that he didn't believe in God. This somehow or other had some intellectual appeal. You could be critical of all of the known religions and still say, I don't know whether there's a God or not. This is the appeal to an intellectual snob of the concept of the agnostic. But being of that thinking, I had considerable trouble with the third step. I mentioned Freddie Williams from Maslin, sitting back there. Freddie made a comment at one of the meetings in Canton shortly after I had attended my first one, in which he pointed out that the third step doesn't say that we have to believe in a power greater than ourselves as a condition to coming into AA or as a prerequisite for being accepted as a member in AA. That third step starts out, we came to believe. We came to believe, which intimates that this can take some period of time. I shall never forget that because I went home that night saying to myself, if I keep my mouth shut and my ears open, perhaps I shall come to believe that a power greater than myself can restore me to sanity. I'm sorry, this is the second step. Excuse me. I had trouble with the third step. It was impossible for me to make a decision to turn my will and the care of my life over to God, even as I understood Him, because I didn't understand Him. I had no understanding of that power greater than I was. This worried me some. I had read the stories in the big book. I had read especially Bill's spiritual experience, as he called it, in Towns Hospital in New York. Somehow or other, I was sorry that I hadn't had the experience of angels coming to see me with trumpets and bright lights and so forth. I haven't had one of those to this day. And again, one of the members of AA who made a comment one night solved that problem for me. He too had had difficulty because of his failure to have a spiritual experience. You know, that 12th step used to read spiritual experience. Now it reads spiritual awakening, but same difference. Anyway, this fellow said that he was looking for some objective evidence of a spiritual experience. He hadn't had it. No flashing lights, no angels to see him either. And he had been sober for a period of perhaps 6 months. And he said he was lying in bed one night thinking about his own problems. Here he had had a period of sobriety of 6 months when prior to his coming to AA, several weeks had been the longest period of sobriety that he'd been able to achieve. And it suddenly occurred to him that his 6 months sobriety was in itself a spiritual experience. Well, here again, perhaps I was at the point where I was receptive to this kind of a statement. I had been sober about this time 5 or 6 months, and on the way home, I too said to myself, why can't I accept my experience of sobriety of 6 months as my spiritual experience? The longest period of sobriety I'd had in some 11 or 12 years was about 10 days. And here I had had some 6 months of sobriety because of my coming to AA. I have found since then, let me say this first, that having come to that conclusion, that my period of sobriety itself constituted a spiritual experience, I began to feel somehow or other less ashamed of being an alcoholic. I began to lose that feeling of reluctance in discussing alcoholism, and particularly my own alcoholism, with non-alcoholics. In other words, I began to feel contented with my lot. Now, this is quite an accomplishment. If you're an alcoholic, to be contented with your lot. My friend Carl Weaver down in Canton used to say that he was an engineer by training. And he said, I can understand that facts are facts. And if I can accept my alcoholism as a fact, then I will consider it as being indisputable and I will be able to accept it. Well, that's another way of saying it. But I know this, that having had this spiritual experience, so-called, permitted me to accept with some degree of contentment the fact that I was an alcoholic, the fact that I, and today that I am an alcoholic, and the fact that once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. I've had a great many experiences since then, which I can describe in no other way except to say they were spiritual experiences. Any of you members of AA who have done any 12th step work at all, I know have had spiritual experiences of a varied nature. I know you've had a great many of them. And I know that you will have a great many more, because this is a spiritual program through and through. I'm very grateful to say to you today that so far as my association with Alcoholics Anonymous is concerned, nothing but good has come out of it. In these some 18 years, I have heard no criticism of my having come to AA, quite the contrary. Now, I don't mean to say that there may not have been people who have criticized me. God knows I deserve it on many an occasion. What I'm trying to say to you is that whatever criticism I may have had, none of it was directed to my association with AA. I know, too, from my own personal experience, that the fact of being an alcoholic and the further fact of being associated with Alcoholics Anonymous in no way detracts from your ability to get along in the outside world. By that I mean in no way detracts from your ability to get ahead in whatever vocation you have selected for yourself. In 1948, there was a graduate student over at Kent University by the name of Ritchie. He was working on his master's degree, and for his thesis, he selected the topic of a history of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I dare say that there are some of the people in this room who were interviewed by this fellow, Ritchie, in getting material for this thesis. Anyway, he wrote the thesis. He interviewed a great many alcoholics in this area and in other areas. His thesis was published later in the Yale Law School Journal of Applied Physiology, I think it's called. He described the beginnings of AA. He said that, in his opinion, the work of AAs was a substitute for drinking. And, of course, his idea was that nobody could quit drinking without having something to substitute for it, so that the time that they had could be utilized in some constructive manner. At the end of his article, he raised a very significant question, which he didn't answer, by the way. He said that he wondered, from having talked with all of these people in AA, and having approached the fellowship of AA from a so-called sociological point of view, as to whether alcoholics who recovered in AA would ever be able to return to their normal place in their community and carry on, and I use the term normal again advisedly, carry on normal activities in their community to the same extent as non-alcoholics do. Well, this is a very significant question. And I think we all know that there are many people in AA who really use AA as a crutch sometimes when they shouldn't. Now, it's all well and good, and I'm the first to espouse the principle that AA must come first in my life. I believe it sincerely. Without sobriety, I have nothing and will have nothing without sobriety. And yet, I don't believe that this means that there aren't some other things that I must do in this world, both connected with my vocation and also connected with the community in which I live, which perhaps have nothing to do with AA. I have found, and I think you have found, that there's a very thin line between knowing what to do and what not to do so far as letting AA come first in your life. For instance, and this may be a silly example, but suppose you've got a child in school and they're having open house at the school, which they had here last week, and it falls on the same night of your regular AA meeting. Is it more important for you to go to that AA meeting, or is it more important for you to go to that kid's open house? I'm not going to try to give you the answer. But this is the kind of problem that we have to meet every day. Is it more important for you to take your wife to some place that she's been wanting to go for a long time on some evening when you particularly wanted to go and hear Mr. So-and-so speak? When your wife starts to do the dishes, is it more important for you to get out so you can be 20 minutes early to the meeting and help set up the tables rather than help her with the dishes so that she can go with you? Again, I'm not going to try to answer these questions. But surely, just as surely as I stand here, this is the kind of question that must be answered by all of us if we want to keep our emotional graph, if I may use that term, in any kind of a constant or at a constant level. Now, in closing, let me just say one thing. And this really ties in with what I said at the beginning. I don't know how AA works. I don't know how many of you people could stand up and recite verbatim the 12 steps of the program. Maybe a good many of you could. I don't know how many of you people have tried to work these 12 steps in great detail. For example, how many of you have made a written statement of your inventory as required in step 4 and step 10. I don't know how many of you indulge in prayer as I understand prayer. And it doesn't make any difference. Again, I come back, this is an individual program. And let me close with this thought, two thoughts really. First of all, gratitude has a short memory. And secondly, and this is not original with me, When someone asks me today how AA works, my first answer is this: it works just fine. Thank you very much.